Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working at...
An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, welcome, everybody. Chuck Bonnio, Julie Hayden, the Chuck and Julie Grassroots Show, Truth Straight Up.
Brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. So much to talk about today. Trump's speech. What a speech. Mayor Johnston gets scorched in Congress. So much for a sanctuary city policy.
So much for $2 million. The governor in Berlin should have prepared him better.
That's right. But want to start off today with Professor John Ellis. He's the author of A Short History of Relations Between Peoples and has some great columns up regarding sort of the dangers of DEI, critical race theory, what's going on in the education department. So, Professor Ellis, thank you and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes. So, first, I want to see, did you have a chance to watch the speech or read anything about Trump's speech last night? Because he basically said, hey, we're getting rid of DEI, and just wanted to get your take on that.
Well, it's great that he's getting rid of DEI, but he also said we're getting rid of woke. Unfortunately, I think it'll take a lot more than banning DEI to get rid of woke, because woke is completely entrenched in our colleges and universities, and you're going to have to really reform the colleges before you can get rid of wokeness. What they'll do, what the campuses will do, is just hunker down and wait for a friendlier administration. But there is one thing. There is one thing you can do, which is, you can do something about the political monopoly on the campuses.
But walk us back a little bit, and I know we've talked about it, and Chuck has talked about it a lot before. But how did it get there? I mean, how did that develop?
Well, okay. Look, the first thing is to understand the problem, and basically, what has happened over the last 50 years is that the radical left, which was, 50 years ago, just a fringe group with no constituency, really, that group decided to take over the universities because that was a means of getting influence in the society. But they knew they couldn't do it by elections. No one would ever elect those people. So what they did was they worked very slowly and very deliberately, and, starting off from 1969, when left and right are not equal on the campuses, but they're kind of right about 60-40. I mean, 60 left, 40 right. That's easily enough to have a good, healthy debate on campuses and for kids to get a good education in the ideas of both sides. Now, you start off from there, within 30 years, that's the year 2000, turn of the century, the radical left is 5-1. Now, when you've got 5-1, you've got control, because you control every meeting, every faculty meeting. And from that point onward, since they've got control, they make sure that everyone who's appointed to professorships is left. So over the next 10, 15 years, the numbers accelerate. So you go from 5-1, 2000. 5 years later, it's 8-1. After about another 6 or 7 years, it's up to about 12-1. It's now above 15-1. And what they're doing now, since they've got, complete control, what they're now doing is harassing the few remaining conservatives to get them to retire. They're usually the people they're harassing are the greatest brains in their departments. Anyway, so what you now have is a monopoly. To appreciate just how dangerous a monopoly is, I mean, I think the best person who ever expressed an opinion on this kind of thing is John Stuart Mill. Let me read you something that he wrote, which is really brilliant and explains exactly what's gone wrong. He said, a party of order and stability, in other words, conservatives, and a party of progress and reform, which means leftists, are both necessary elements of a healthy state of political life. And it's in a great measure the opposition of the other that keeps each within the limits of reason and sanity. So what he's really saying is, if once you get a political monopoly with the other party missing, that's the road to insanity, and that's it. It's exactly what's happened. Wokeness is a form of insanity. So what we need to take seriously is that while you have college campuses with the radical left having a political monopoly, you can't expect them to be other than stupid. I mean, that's the condition that they will get to, because they lack any opposition on the campuses. And if you lack any opposition, that means that there's no one there to correct you when you say something that doesn't work or that's a bit silly. And once you get by with saying things that are a bit silly, because there's no one to tell you they are, the road is open for you to go even further and make even sillier statements, and there's still no one there to correct you. And so wokeness is really the end point of this road. I mean, wokeness is a form of insanity and stupidity that you get if you wind up with a monopoly and no opposition.
Could you give us a definition of wokeness?
I'm sorry?
Definition of wokeness.
How would you define woke?
Well, woke, I mean, woke is a sort of shorthand. I mean, I would say we call wokeness things like criminals as victims, not as victimizers, pronoun craziness, defunding the police, transgenderism, DEI, all kinds of different definitions of oppression. Like, you know, if there are more, proportionally more whites than there are blacks in a particular institution, that's oppression automatically, regardless of how it got to be that way or regardless of merit. So, in other words, definitions of oppression that are so expansive they can reach anywhere. All that kind of thing, that's wokeness.
But, you know, and what they do is not just the faculty. A few years ago on our show, we talked to a young woman, and she was going to, I think, DU, and she got kicked out. And she'd been on a trip. It was a student trip with a faculty member, and the faculty member was trashing Donald Trump. This is a few years ago. And she made some comment that, you know, hey, I don't like you trashing Trump. I support Trump. And she came back and they filed a complaint against her, like harassment or something like that. Remember? And she ended up getting kicked out of the university for it. And it was like, so it's, you know, like the faculty does it. And then if you're a student and imagine that's still going on and you even like dare to raise your hand and question you, all of a sudden you're harassing the oppressed, as you pointed out, and they kicked her out. Right. And that really screwed her because they didn't give her money back. And of course, now this is a record following her trying to get admitted to other colleges. I mean, other woke places.
Yeah. And the thing to remember is that this event will be known to thousands of other kids. They'll learn about it, and which means they'll keep quiet. So one of the purposes of doing that to one individual is to intimidate thousands. Mm-hmm. The same thing with faculty at the moment. I mean, there are not many conservatives left now on college campuses. Now, in California, I know most of them. And an awful lot of people I know who are conservatives, who are senior people, usually brilliant people too, the most brilliant people in their departments, they are getting harassed. The left is trying to get them to retire, making life a misery.
Yeah.
In one case, there's a made-up complaint of sexism. Well, yeah. when you look into the complaint, you find what it was is a professor had a secretary who was complaining one day to him about the fact that her sister was so much prettier than she was. So my friend, the professor, said to her, "Oh, come on, you're pretty enough." And then someone overheard that and said, oh, he's harassing, he's sexually harassing.
Oh, no. It wasn't even her complaining.
Yeah. And it cost him $10,000 in lawyer's fees to get the university to back off. When I mean, and the secretary explained everything to them and said he wasn't harassing her. He was trying to comfort her when she was complaining about the fact she wasn't as pretty as her sister. Anyway, this is just one example of the way they'll invent some nonsense to try and harass people in retirement. By the way, the professor concerned has now retired. He's sick of the clowns who are running the department. And he's gone. So, and he was the most distinguished guy in the department. He had a huge lab with dozens of students, including minorities and women. And he brought into the campus more money in grant money than anybody else. They don't care. The radicals don't care. Yeah. They wanted to get rid of them because they don't want conservatives around because students might listen to them and believe what they say.
Well, how do you change that? Well, what's the solution to change?
Well, the only long-term solution is that state universities, I mean, you can't touch private universities, unfortunately. Public opinion is your only leverage. There are cases in right now in which public opinion is going up against, like the University of Pennsylvania, which is trying to fire my friend Amy Wax, who is a professor of law, who keeps challenging woke orthodoxy, and they're trying to get rid of her. But in state universities, you've got money provided by the state legislature, and the state legislature has control over the university, theoretically, because it has the money supply, which it can shut off. Now, so obviously this is only going to work in red states, but that's more than half. But it's easy enough, it should be easy enough for the state legislature to say to the university, a political monopoly is unhealthy, it results in stupidity, and we're not going to put up with it, and you better come up with a plan to break up that monopoly or we'll cut off your funding. Now, the problem is that that takes some guts.
Yeah.
And so far, although there are, there's super majorities in some red states, you cannot persuade those legislators to do this because they shrink from the responsibility of doing it. They fear the backlash from the left. But they've got to do it. I mean, and I think that's what Donald Trump's speech is a wonderful thing because he talked about getting rid of woke. Well, I hope now that people in red states with supermajorities will look at that statement and realizing they have the backing of the national government. So they could, they could in fact just... It was the easiest thing in the world for the legislature, the people in the education department of the legislature, just simply say to the president of the local state university, you've got a dreadful, unhealthy situation politically. It's a situation that's bound to result in foolishness and low standards. And you know very well, everybody knows that it's true.
Right.
And you've got to change it. And if you don't change it, we'll cut off your money.
How is the president going to change it?
Yeah, how would you go about if you're the president and you're like, actually, you're right. Because I would imagine a lot of the professors in the pipeline, so to speak, there's no point in starting if you're conservative. I mean, how do you, if the university, let's say some miracle occurred, it's not going to happen in Denver, but, and they said, you're right. I mean, because you can't have how would you go about doing that? Do you
think? Well, you'd have to, you'd have to fire whole departments, for example, Department of Ethnic Studies, the Department of Women's Studies, the Department of Black Studies, Department of Chicano Studies. None of them have real scholars in them. They wouldn't be missed. And you'd use the money made available by that to hire people who are not radical left. Yeah, it wouldn't even be any harm to hire centrist centrist Democrats. I mean, what you've got to get away from is this monopoly of the radical left. Now, you're going to ask, you're going to tell me that where do you find them? Well, the answer to that is that there are people hidden all over the place in those universities. They're hiding. You know, I mean, there probably are still about 5% left of the faculty who really want a decent place to work, and they would jump at the chance to get to a place where they can work properly, where they can be appreciated. So I think you'd be amazed at how many people you'd find who would come out of the woodwork from universities all over the country, who would be delighted to get back to a good environment again. But it would mean, you know, tough choices to be made. And there's no doubt that the existing president of whatever state university you're talking about wouldn't do it. You have to fire them. And you put in new management, and you simply tell the new management to just tell their faculty that there's going to be an end of this political monopoly. It's unjustified. It's unpatriotic. It's uneducational. It's completely illegitimate. There's no purpose for it whatsoever except to spread political propaganda. So it has to change. If it doesn't change, we'll defund you.
What about in terms of federal? Wait, let me ask that. In terms of federal funding, too. I mean, I know that, you know, the President Trump and DOGE are going through and cutting U.S. aid things. You know, you talked about the state legislature. How much in university land do the NGOs and the grants that come from the NGOs? How much do they contribute? Are they? I would assume they're a big factor.
Well, the biggest factor is things like the National Science Foundation, which, you know, gets money from the government and then distributed to scientific researchers, and that's huge amounts of money. If you cut out the NSF funding, the universities would be crippled. But that's anyway, you know, money. That's the only thing that these people would understand. I mean, if they're told they're out of a job unless they reform, they'll reform. But you need people with intestinal fortitude. You need people willing to stand up to the president of the university and tell him he's got to change or else. And the academy, I mean, professors will always try to tell you, other people, that they don't really understand universities, that this is a complicated intellectual problem, and only brilliant people like them can really understand universities. And you have to be prepared to say to them, nonsense. What you're really saying is you're too gutless to reform yourselves.
Well, I went to Vanderbilt University, what Cornelius Vanderbilt founded in the 1870, and Leland Stanford founded Stanford and Duke. Tried to. Why can't a billionaire these days find, 500 acres out somewhere and say, great, new university, we're going to hire whoever we want, and it ain't going to be you lefties. And, you know, there's a huge built-up demand. I mean, like we have a now 14-year-old son, and deciding where he's going to school is, you know, it's pretty thin pickings. I mean, Hillsdale, somebody started Austin University down in Texas.
Austin, your best bet is Austin.
Probably. Okay, well, it's
so you can wait for the billionaires to say, well, you know, something.
Well, you have to wait. I mean, why can't there be billionaires starting up a couple of universities? There's a huge number of students who would want to go to that kind of university. Except there's very little choices.
Yeah, well, no, it's a good proposition. There's got to be a lot of, as you know, there are a lot of tech billionaires around. They could afford to, some of them could afford to found a university and then staff it with the right people. Now, you know, if you wanted to cast your net a bit wider, there's a few places, like England, for example. Thatcher, one of the things Margaret Thatcher did, which very little people know about, was she founded some new places. So the University of Buckingham, for example, is a first-rate place. because Thatcher found it, she made absolutely sure that it got the right people running it. So, you know, you could send your kid there, but that's a long way, and you know, the fees for a foreign student are pretty high. But still, you do now have Austin, and there are one or two places, like Florida, for example. When I said that no one was doing it, I forgot Florida is doing it. I mean, Florida really is cracking the whip and basically, you know, threatening funding cut off if there's no reform. So you've got a couple of places in Florida now that are looking much better than they were.
College was a far-left university, and now it's a right university because it got in there. They threw out the professors they didn't want or otherwise made it unpleasant for them, hired conservative professors. Now, that's a very small place, but it's at least one place where it's done in Florida.
Yeah, no, that's right. No, that is pretty good. And it's got a good board of governors now, including, Chris Rufo. And a few other very good people. Actually, a friend of mine called Scott Yenor is on that board now. So I think that you can figure that that place is going to thrive. It's going to, I mean, you know, look, sooner or later, as that place we're talking about, I think is what, West Florida? I think as that gels, as it gets moving, and as it appoints new people, it's going to draw in all kinds of people like you. I mean, your 14-year-old right. son, he'll be applying for college in about 3 years. My guess is within those 3 years, West Florida will be really on the move. And we'll
that's
really
true. Once
gather-
it starts. Yep. Well, listen, Professor, we have to let you go. I want to give you the opportunity, though. I know because you've got numerous books out there, and your latest book, A Short History of Relations Between Peoples. Where can people find out more about you, get your books, read your columns, et cetera?
Well, I mean, the other book that people would be interested in is the one that's called The Breakdown of Higher Education, How It Happened, the Damage It Does, and what can be done about it. That probably is the book that is most squarely in the middle of the concerns you're raising. And that's in Counter Books, and you can get it, you know, on Amazon and so on. And otherwise, if you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, I've done about 10 articles in the Wall Street Journal, very long articles over the last 3-4 years. And if you just get into the Wall Street Journal website, you can pick all of them up that way.
That's very cool. Okay, sir, thank you for your time.
Appreciate your time.
Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Have a great day, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Professor John Ellis. And some great comments here from Jim. If we can get more conservative judges, students, and teachers, they can file lawsuits from the right viewpoint for discrimination, for damages, money talks. And Charlene, I agree with this too. Each person speaking up influences the zeitgeist. Is that how you say it?
Zeitgeist.
Okay. I know what it means, but I don't know how to say it. Politicians then get out in front of public opinion, do stuff like Chuck and Julie. And are the endowment money donors given a tax break? I'm sure they are. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. So, that's kind interesting. And I think
university endowments don't pay any taxes, so they just grow. I mean, Harvard.
How about the donors though? Do the donors get a
sure? It's a C3 and you get a deduction.
I want to talk about happy news. Like I said, a lot to talk about today.
Happy news.
We'll get to all kinds of things. The Supreme Court traitor Amy Coney Barrett, that's not as bad as it may sound initially.
I read the opinion.
Yeah, but when you look at some of it's bad, the opinion, but we'll go right to that then. As I understand it, Jonathan Turley had a column out saying that, okay, it can be appealed and it only takes 4 people to consider the appeal. And so you can do the math and realize, okay, well, they'll agree to review it. So,
what can be appealed?
The fact that there's a March 6th hearing set already in the district court, and Trump can, this was just like an unsigned opinion, right? Apparently Trump can appeal that. And
he
it only takes.
Appeal it's a final decision by the court on a temporary topic.
Okay. All I understand is he can ask for it to be reviewed. This is what Turley says.
Well,
and it goes
back down to
the
court, and whatever decision they make, that can be appealed back up to the court.
Right. And it only takes four to review it, and four said they want to. So I think, I don't know what they were doing. And again, it's on one hand, you're sort of like, thank you, Amy Coney Barrett. But I think, though, you look at some of the stuff out there on social media and it seems like, oh, it's a disaster. But I think like anything, it's far from over.
Well,
Trump.
Oh. I do want to talk briefly about that because I did bother to read the dissent. Okay. Opinion. The gutless majority of six,
five,
refused to write an opinion. They didn't even do a per curiam. They just said denied. And so Alito wrote the opinion for himself and three other conservative justices. And he pointed out how bad it was, how the judge, district judge himself, did everything he could do to prevent a review. He called it a temporary restraining order as opposed to a preliminary injunction, which is not supposed to be reviewable. He gave him 36 hours, which is impossible to appeal up. So he did everything in his possibility of trying not to get his actions reviewed. You'd think that would bring a rebuke by people like John Robovitz, but no, not at all. And it's really amazing when you consider the power that now resides in every district court judge, and the fact that Amy Coney Barrett, who is, there always has to be traitors, there always has to be awful, but she's awful. I mean, it's interesting to watch her facial expressions when the president.
Yeah, she wasn't all cheerful, was she?
No, she was very.
She's like, I'm about to screw you over. Sorry.
Yeah, it's like... she was very. It was not a good look.
You can't bond you. Well, no, right.
Not a good look, and I think it was a disastrous opinion, and I think we do need a constitutional crisis.
Yes, it's going to have to be settled. The Supreme Court is going to have to quit. I saw this a little bit, too, as sort of kicking the can down the road because they said, well, the deadline's already passed, so we're just going to send it back down to the district court to clarify things and to settle things. So it was but the time to kick the can down the road has passed. The Supreme Court, there's a million decisions out there, a million things going on. The Supreme Court just needs to, I think, deal with this and put a stop to it.
Well,
they're
going to limit the power.
Exactly.
Of single and really, you could see a president going, no, I am not going to obey every district court. Yeah, Biden did, but he ignored the Supreme Court. But we're not going to have these nationwide injunctions. We're not going to have these crazy judges just deciding on their own whatever they want.
This is from Charlene. It's not going to happen. The payments will get lost in the mail. Blame it on the incompetency of the remaining Biden holdovers. I think that's a good point. Hey, Jacob, and we're going to get to Trump's speech in a second, but I see Jacob has his hand up. Hey, Jacob.
Okay, two things. There was a decision that the Department of Agriculture had to bring back the people that were laid off for 45 days. I don't know if you saw that.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, the Department of Agriculture says they have to rehire these people for 45 days because they are on their probationary. If you look at the book, if you look at the rules and regs for employment at the federal government, probationary people can be fired for no cause.
Huh.
So where does this judge come off and say?
Right. They're just making it up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just saying that the other thing is that there's a lot of blowback with the Democrats not standing up and cheering for this little kid last night that got the Secret Service Award.
And don't you think whoever came up with the idea, I don't know if you follow Twitter, but so all the stupid Democrats are holding up their little, it's like auction paddles, right? With like little things on them. But every AI person out there on X is like replacing it with like, I'm retarded or Trump 28, 2028, stuff like that. I mean, whoever came up with that idea should be fired. I think that was a really bad. That was a really bad idea. I think the Democrats in general, I mean, from Al Green on down, just look like idiots.
Did you include the Elizabeth Warren?
No, I didn't.
Well, that's my favorite, to tell you the truth. Trump gets up there and says, hundreds of thousands are dying. You want the war to continue for another 5 years? And Elizabeth Warren is just clapping away. Oh, yeah, murder, murder, kill him, kill him. And he looks at it and says, well, yeah, Pocahontas does. And I'm not any sure if ever in a presidential
But that feeds into my last thing is that the liberals and the Democrats, this poor kid, he's fighting cancer. Right. And to them, it would have been better just to make him comfortable and let him die. That's what it is. And it's the same thing with the Ukrainians. Let the war go on. Let them die. As long as we can spend the money on them. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Jacob. Well, then I think, speaking of kid, I think Trump laid it out beautifully because he knew what was going to happen. He knew they were going to sit on their hands. They weren't going to clap for anything. So right at the beginning of the speech, he said, no matter what I say, no matter how good it is or whatever, you're not going to clap. So then every time they didn't, you're like, yep, Trump is right. But there were so many good things he said. I mean, I thought in general, it just took it straight to the Democrats. I think normally at this point in an administration, they don't really have very much to say because they haven't done anything. But Trump has done so much. It was like a State of the Union speech, right? Where he kind of went through and laid everything out. And I thought he was funny, and we'll play some sound from it. But I think it was an amazing speech. And the Democrats just looked like idiots. And then they had their CIA operative, which is kind of funny, give the rebuttal. But what did your take on it?
Too long, 2 hours. It's always too long. Ever, yeah. An hour and 15 minutes would be much better. They came to the very end, and he had these great lines that, I forget what they were, lots of alliteration, everything else. And he should have ended there. It really had all of it.
It almost had kind of two endings. Yeah.
It's Obama ending. If he ended there, it would have been a crescendo. But no, he, ended that, and then did another one. But I thought it was great. Overall, I think Democrats embarrassed themselves. I think, secondly, Trump really just showed he's a force of nature. I mean, he said, hey, this isn't, we're not slowing down.
This is not your father's Republican Party.
Yeah, and no, and we are just going to plow ahead. And, if you doubt it, I always thought it was ridiculous about Greenland.
And he's like, no, hey, Greenland. Well, and here's the thing.
He may well invade Greenland.
And people loved it, right? I mean, it had like a 70, even CBS, a 76% approval rating. I mean, and the Democrats did not look good. But then what he talked about is draining the swamp. And again, it wasn't just talk. He's doing it. So, Doug, if we could please play the Trump bureaucrats soundbite.
Americans have given us a mandate for bold and profound change. For nearly 100 years, the federal bureaucracy has grown until it has crushed our freedoms, ballooned our deficits, and held back America's potential in every possible way. The nation founded by pioneers and risk takers now drowns under millions and millions of pages of regulations and debt. Approvals that should take 10 days to get, instead take 10 years, 15 years, and even 20 years before you're rejected. Meanwhile, we have hundreds of thousands of federal workers who have not been showing up to work. My administration will reclaim power from this unaccountable bureaucracy, and we will restore true democracy to America again. And any federal bureaucrat who resists this change will be removed from office immediately. Because we are draining the swamp. It's very simple. And the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over.
So there you go. And I think people who suffered through COVID have no problem with that. And then he talked about immigration. And I mean, it's like the border apprehensions have dropped like 90% or something like 98%. Yeah, 98%. I mean, people, it's like we talked about earlier, you put out the message, if you come here, you're going to be sent back. You're not going to have free luxury hotel, lodging in New York City. So people quit coming. And so it wasn't all that hard to do after all. Doug, if we could please play the Trump, this is a great line, the Trump new president soundbite.
The media and our friends in the Democrat Party kept saying we needed new legislation. We must have legislation to secure the border. But it turned out that all we really needed was a new president.
I think that was funny. I know, but I kind of loved watching J.D. Vance and Mike Johnson are particularly animated, I thought, during the whole thing. They did a great job. And then finally, this is another soundbite he liked. You know, where, you know, we talked with Professor Ellis about the woke and certain things. Everybody's oppressed. And I think Trump has recognized and what, I mean, that the vast majority of the American people do not want men playing in girls' sports. They don't want men using women's bathrooms. And Trump basically also said, hey, we're putting a stop to that nonsense, too. So, Doug, if we could please play the Trump transgender soundbite.
I also signed an order to cut off all taxpayer funding to any institution that engages in the sexual mutilation of our youth. Congress to pass a bill permanently banning and criminalizing sex changes on children and forever ending the lie that any child is trapped in the wrong body. This is a big lie. And our message to every child in America is that you are perfect exactly the way God made you.
I mean, there you go, right? It's like you'd think that that would be the kind of message that the Democrats could embrace, right? That every child, you are perfect the way God made you. But it's like, no, the Democrats are like, no, you are perfect the way we will remake you. So I thought it was a great speech. I mean, way off to work again today, right? In the meantime, though, China and Canada, they're talking about tariffs again, right? So I think Trump has shown that he's willing, he's not just talking, right? He's willing to follow through. And I think, again, he's achieved more, I think, in the first, whatever, you know, the first month or so than most president, than Biden ever did.
Well, yeah, no president, even Roosevelt didn't accomplish this. And because one thing to go in and just add thousands of new employees, new departments, new everything else. It's another thing to really get a hold of a behemoth that is choking the country. And if you're a federal employee, and I was a federal employee as a law clerk for a judge at GS 13, I think. It's federal employees are not feeling good right now.
No. Well, and all the court cases come and go.
And but all the stuff about, you know, I could go out there and make a lot more money in the private sector is all bullshit. In fact, you know, I mean, when I clerked, I thought I worked pretty hard. I mean, I got the office at 7, left it at 5, but I didn't work weekends, except
holidays.
When we had emergencies or holidays. Sometimes we had emergencies and so on. And then when I got out into the practice of law at a law firm, it was, you know, 7 o'clock. You're here at 7? What's wrong with you? You know, why weren't you here 2 hours ago? And what do you mean going home at 7 at night? I mean, weekend? What's a weekend? Sundays? We don't recognize
Sundays.
That's like
casual dress day, isn't
it? Yeah, casual, right.
Hey, Charlene, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I just had two things that I noticed that I'd like to share.
Sure.
And one of them was when Marco Rubio, when he was heaping praise on all of his cabinet, he was kind of hesitant to heap too much on Marco. Did you notice that?
I did notice that too.
Weird. He said, you know, the fact that you were confirmed 99-1, that, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, and which kind of, you know, I've had that question about Marco Rubio the whole time. And so he was like, he just didn't heap the praise on him. And Marco looked a little bit sheepish when he was,
I went back
and watched it again this morning, and I thought, did I just, you know, was that just my bias, or did
a little bit? I think Marco has surprised everybody on how good he's been.
Yes,
I think he's been so much better than I think everybody thought, and he's been such a strong advocate that he was, you know, more in a friendly way, kind of ribbing him, as you do that.
It could have been that too, but I kind of thought Marco maybe dropped the ball a little bit when they had that showdown with Zelensky. You know, he was in the White House. He was in there. And I don't think he maybe he should have known that Susan Rice and all them were meeting over there in Europe, you know?
And I had the same thing as Chuck. I back and forth, I was like, you're absolutely right in that. That was a weird moment, right?
Yes, now, it was.
For the weirdness, I was sort of with Chuck. I thought maybe he's trying to send Rubio a message and this is a weird way to do it. Or maybe he's joking with him and this is a weird way to do it. But either way, I agree with you.
He was sending him a message by joking with him, I think. But you're thinking he was joking with them and he sent a message when he joked with them. I don't know which
you always, you know, you rib those you like the best, those you hate.
And I thought he was not very heaping of praise on Pam Bondi either. I mean, he on RFK and, you know, Pete Hegseth, it was just like overflowing. There was no hesitation whatsoever. But with Pam Bondi and with Marco Rubio, I noticed a little bit of hesitation. Yeah. But Chuck, maybe he likes him the best, and that's why he's, you know, ribbing him. I don't know. But anyway, and then the other thing I noticed was that they were both animated, like you said, Julie, JD and Marco. But there was when Trump said tariffs, what's his name? Johnson. Not animated. And it wasn't a scowl really, but he kind of looked out into the audience like he was making connection with someone. If you go back and look at it, you'll see what I mean.
Well, I imagine he's got, and the members of Congress are coming at this, are not as unified on it as Trump is about it, right?
Yeah, and he kind of, he was kind of giving a look like, that may not happen.
Do we have to talk about tariffs right now?
yeah, exactly. Or that may not happen. And then the other thing is that when he said to Thune, you're going to help us do this, right? And then he said, Thune's going to help us do it. He had the way of heaping praise and then pointing out, you know, this is what we need at the same time. So I just kind of, you know, I like to see how he praises people. It's just really interesting. But, I think the best line of the night was when he said, come to find out, we didn't need new legislation. We needed a new president. I mean, that just made me laugh out loud.
I think that was a perfect line too, Charlene.
Okay,
thank
thanks.
You. And I think he made it clear, like you said, we're going to go forward. The American people supported him. If you're the Democrats, you still got nothing. And somebody said, doing those stupid placards again.
They have double nothing.
Yeah, they have double. Yeah.
I've never seen the Democratic Party be that depressed, delusioned, this is supposed to be the time where they get to attack Trump.
Right.
Now they're on the attack finally after 4 years of being on the defense for Biden, and they ain't much of it.
All they can do is attack, you have to support, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. They have to support all these issues the American people don't like.
Did you watch the Democratic response?
I did not.
It was lame.
Well, and she was a CIA operative. I mean, it's like a former, it's like, typical that. Do you want to real quick, or should we save it for Friday to talk about the Mike Johnston testimony? I want to play one soundbite because they're kind of long. So Denver mayor and three other sanctuary city mayors went to Washington. Actually, we have time to play a couple. Went to Washington, D.C., were grilled by Jim Jordan, particularly over the sanctuary city policies. And as you noted out, Denver Mayor Mike Johnson paid $2 million to a law firm to prep him, but it did not go well. I'm going to play you a series of sound bites here. Jim Jordan started out by asking him about a criminal illegal alien who was just released from the Denver jail by the name of Abraham Gonzalez. And Doug, if we could please play Jordan number one.
Mayor Johnston, who's Abraham Gonzalez?
Thank you, Congressman. He is a individual that was released from the county jail on Friday in the city and county of Denver.
That's all you know about him?
I do know that he was facing charges that the
Venezuelan gang member arrested by Border Patrol on September 20th, 2023, released into the country by the Biden administration. A few months later, he's arrested in your city, charged with aggravated assault. On March 11th, 2024, he's charged with motor vehicle theft, stole a car. And then on March 20th, 2024, Mr. Gonzalez is charged with felony menacing. 6 days after that last charge, I send you a detainer, which includes an administrative warrant. Basically, it says if you're going to release this bad guy, this gang member who allegedly stole a car, menaced people, and assaulted people, give us a 48-hour heads up. Is that right? That refresh your memory?
I do know about the detainer request. I do know that we provided a notification of release.
What kind of notice did you give ICE when you released him?
We gave him notification. I'm not sure how long
one
in advance.
Hour.
It was. I do
one
know that.
One hour.
I do know that there was
1 hour notice.
I mean, and so then it gets worse from there. So what happens is they gave him an hour notice. So the ICE agents show up, and then the guy, rather than arresting him taking him into custody inside the jail,
right?
They release him out on the streets, and then he assaults the officers. So he assaults the officers. They have to tase him. Everything goes to pieces. And we're going to skip the second bite, Doug. But then Jordan says, what the frick? If you had simply allowed ICE to go into the facility and take him into custody there, everything would have been, you know, you deliberately screwed the pooch. You deliberately set up this dangerous situation. And if we could please play Jordan number three, Doug.
As we coordinated the release.
An officer got assaulted because of your policy, which says we're going to release him to, in your words, not mine, to the streets. They have to arrest him in the parking lot. They bring six officers when they could have had one or two just come in your facility, in the jail, and take the guy there. But you won't do it that way.
I've seen the video. I've reached out to ICE. I've offered to sit down and coordinate on strategies. If we need to make adjustments to what we do on releases, we'll do that. This is the first time in the 1,226 releases.
You know, I read your written testimony last night. 4.5 pages. And you used the word safe, safer, or safety 13 times. Talking about my job is to protect is the safety of the people in Denver. We prioritizing making sure everyone in our community is safe. That's a lie. Because it was not safer for the ICE agents who are part of your community. No way was it safer. The safest thing to do is to say, ICE, we got him in custody. Come here, we're releasing. We held him 345 days. We can't hold him a second longer. We can't wait for you to come inside the building. We got to let him go, so you have to arrest him in the parking lot. That is how stupid sanctuary policies are and what they mean to the community that you put at risk and to the ICE officers, who was assaulted. And they had to use a taser on them. It's not good.
Mr. Chairman.
It's like, I don't think Mayor Johnson, I don't think they grill them when they help prepare him for testifying, right? I don't imagine
he's money back from Lincoln Burton.
He's like, he should have just had him do Jim Jordan. And then I think Lauren Boebert asked him questions. Gabe Evan asked him questions. Even I saw some stuff with Jeff Crank asking him questions. And then Representative Luna said she wants to refer them all because they all acknowledge that they paid to put up illegal immigrants. So she said, well, that's aiding and abetting. So she referred them all to the Department of Justice for criminal investigation. Now, I'm sure the Democrats are going to be like, oh, he was heroic. He was heroic. But, Jim Jordan, it's like, that's perfect, right? You could have just followed the law, did it nicely and safely, but nope, you have to do it in a sanctuary city way that makes it a pain for everybody else and dangerous for everybody else. And what John, I mean, I don't know, though. Here's my question to you, Chuck. You know, with the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle, you guys are, you know, we're on Denver all the time. Do you think the people of Denver are going to wake up?
No. It'll get worse and worse. I mean, just compare, let's say 8 years ago, what the city council was like. You know, it had a lot of people that I'd call, you know, middle left. Today, a majority of them are progressive socialists. No, Denver is not getting less woke. It is getting more woke.
Yeah.
So no, they're not. It's not changing anytime. I mean, you know, if you know, there are lots of people, but they're not in Denver that go down to downtown and say, "This is awful. We got homeless. We have crime. We have everything else." But you don't see any city council people doing that. They're not, you know, oh, no, this is great.
I mean, need more bike lanes, even though they're destroying. And yeah. I know while we're at it, that's totally destroy Colfax and put a bus lane that no one will ride in.
And do one on Colorado Boulevard next. I mean,
right.
You know, what's really the fun part is, you know, near our office, we have a lot of these bollards by at four-way places. And they basically cut the lane down to one for no reason other than they want to make it difficult for cars. That's
right.
The only reason.
Right.
It doesn't help anything. It doesn't help bicyclists. It doesn't help pedestrians. But there it is. And so, no, I mean, it's we'll soon have mandatory sex change operations.
Well, maybe the illegal immigrants will start complaining about that, because if there aren't any cars, there are not enough cars for them to squeegee.
That's true.
You know what I mean? So that's oppression. That's oppression right there. Hey, coming up on that's going to do it for us today. On Party Friday, we have John Conlon coming on. He has a great column saying, hey, we got Doge. Now we need a Department of Door, Department of, what do you call it? Actual results. Department of Actual Results. He said, let's just take a look at that. And he kind of has a great column about all the things that we're paying for that no one even actually measures. Does this actually ever accomplish anything?
No.
It's like, what a silly question, right?
Silly, silly, silly.
Also, there is, in local politics, another rhino opt-out weasel number two that we need to alert you on. I've got a new strategy, equally weaselly, but just a little bit tricky. So you'll explain all of that, right?
We'll try.
Hey, but that'll do it for us today.
Take care, everybody. We'll see you Wednesday. And
no, it's a beautiful party Friday.
It goes so fast.
Bye, everyone.
Take care.